Ahoy.
Hello.
And welcome to Policy Voices by Friends of Europe, an independent think tank with a difference. Each week from Brussels, we bring you powerful conversations with policy voices from around the world. Policy Voices talking policy choices.
What we're seeing since October 7, we're seeing a sort of attack on journalism as a whole. And the objective is clear. It is to create a media blackout in Gaza. Because effectively what we have is journalists being killed. We know that in the case of at least 22 of them, we have enough elements to speak of direct targeting linked to their jobs. The journalists were identifiable. The journalists were working. The journalists were isolated when a strike hits them. The journalists were killed by snipers. The journalists had received threats. So all of these are elements that allow us to identify immediate intentional targeting.
Hello and welcome to Policy Voices, Friends of Europe's weekly podcast on European and global affairs. I'm your host, Katerina Villanova. A week ago, I spoke to Jonathan Dagger, the head of the Middle East desk at Reporters Without Borders. Reporters Without Borders, or RSF for short, has been documenting the crimes perpetrated by Israel against journalists in Gaza. So far, at least 100 reporters have been killed and 22 died in the course of their work. Jonathan recently returned from Doha, where he met with Palestinian journalists who escaped from Gaza and told their tales of being targeted by Israel. What Jonathan described is a pattern of impunity with journalists facing the unimaginable situation of covering the deaths of their family members, friends, and colleagues. On World Press Freedom Day, we wanted to dedicate this episode of Policy Voices to the journalists in Gaza reporting a war while seeking shelter, water, and food. Here's my conversation with Jonathan Dagger, the head of the Middle East desk at Reporters Without Borders. Hello, Jonathan Dagger, and welcome to Policy Voices. How are you doing this morning?
Hello, I'm good. Thank you. Thank you for having us today.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you today on the show. It's a great coincidence that we are releasing this episode of Policy Voices on May 3rd, which is World Press Freedom Day. And it's also the day that Reporters Without Borders, RSF for short, is releasing its World Press Freedom Index for the year of 2024. And I wanted to start today's conversation exactly with this index that RSF releases every year. And I wanted to ask you, what can you tell us already about this year's findings? What were the most significant changes since last year?
Yes, as you mentioned, RSF every year publishes the RSF Press Freedom Index on the 3rd of May, which is the International Press Freedoms Day. And in this press index, for those who might not know, we basically, all 180 countries in the world are scored according to 5 different indicators. And these scores are compiled to create one single score, and then they are ranked according to that score. And the 5 indicators are political, social, economic, legal, and of course, security, which measures the number of journalists killed or arrested or kidnapped or disappeared in a certain zone or territory. What's flagrant in this year's index, as you can see on our website and in the press release we just published, is that there is a drastic drop in the political indicator, which basically, this is worldwide, but this is more prominent in the zone that I cover in the Middle East. I would say this is very prominent in the zone that I covered, to not get into the comparative, but this shows that basically states and political actors are not doing their jobs of protecting the press and journalists and media outlets, of not fostering an environment where journalists and media outlets can work to create a safe, to create a free, independent, and pluralistic information ecosystem. As you know, RSF defends everyone's right to have access to free, independent, pluralistic information. And it is the duty of states and governments and political actors to enforce conditions that would allow journalists to work in an environment that would produce such news. Unfortunately, what we're seeing today is that states have taken a step back, to put it lightly. They've completely abandoned, in some cases, their duty to do that. And in some cases, they've actively enforced the opposite kind of environment, which is unfortunately the case in the Middle East. Now, this translates in many ways. It translates into pressure on journalists, both financial, political pressures. It translates in very difficult security situations, intimidation. And one of the things that I would like to focus on today is that this translates into widespread impunity for crimes committed against journalists, because impunity for crimes committed against journalists comes from a political framework. It comes from a political cover for these crimes. It comes when political authorities either do not enforce or actively obstruct mechanisms or just of justice that are put in place, whether locally or internationally, in order to bring justice for journalists who are killed. And nowhere is that more visible today in the world, is that more flagrant in recent history than it is in Gaza, where since October 7, at least 100 journalists have been killed in Gaza by Israeli forces, of whom 22 lost their lives while they were working in the context of their work. There has been no justice for these crimes whatsoever. In fact, the massacre continues, and we're calling on the international community, governments, leaders, political organizations to do everything in their power to up the pressure on the Israeli authorities to stop this massacre and to protect the journalists who are still working in Gaza.
You, just a couple months ago, you were in Doha in your work as the head of the Middle East desk at RSF, where you met with some Palestinian journalists who seek refuge in Doha. What can you tell us about your trip to Doha and the journalists that you met that had to flee Gaza? What accounts did they share? What stories stuck out the most with you?
The decision to go to Doha on a mission to Doha came after we saw that several emblematic journalists, but also in my opinion, all the journalists doing work today in Gaza are worthy of praise because of their bravery in the face of such horrible and difficult circumstances. And so several of them had left Gaza and were able to obtain visas to Doha. So given that we couldn't go to Gaza to visit them for obvious conditions, but also because of the media blockade imposed on Gaza by Israel, we decided to go to the next nearest place, which was Doha. And this was following the evacuation of our correspondent, Aula Al-Zanoun, and four of her children. Her fifth is thankfully not in Gaza. And her husband was still there when we went. But recently, in the past couple of weeks, he also was able to leave Gaza and join them. There was also Al Jazeera's journalist, Wael Al-Dahdouh. He's the head of the Al Jazeera Bureau. Wael Al-Dahdouh rose to fame because of his stellar journalism during the war in Gaza, his coverage of the reality on the ground for the people in Gaza. Unfortunately, he also suffered huge losses. His wife, two of his children, and two of his grandchildren were killed in Israeli strike on Rafah in 2023. And then in the beginning of 2024, his eldest son, Hamza Al-Dahdouh, who was a freelance journalist working with Al Jazeera, was also killed in another strike on his car. Wael himself was injured in a strike on December 15th that killed his colleague Samer Abu Dakka from Al Jazeera, and that injured his arm. And so when we met Wael, he was actually the first journalist we met after Aula, and he had his arm in a cast while he was speaking to us. We also met with Mahmoud Al-Hams, who is an AFP journalist and a colleague of Aula's husband, Adil Zanoun, who was, like I said, still in Gaza. We met with Musa Zanoun, who is Aula's son, who's a freelance journalist. And we also met with another journalist who preferred to remain unidentified, but he works for an international media organization. But he did not go on the record. He just shared with us the difficulties of working in Gaza. And so meeting with these journalists, I cannot emphasize how touching and impacting it was. I mean, not just because their stories are so touching, but also because it's... Well, for me, for example, I considered it really a privilege to be able to speak to these people, to be able to speak with them firsthand and to listen to their stories. On the news, they usually put themselves out of the story. They're covering, they're reporting, they try to remove themselves. And RSF is here to really show what it takes to do that and the price that these people have had to pay. And they've had to pay an enormous price. And as I noted, like there's a truth to what they're saying that isn't just in their words. It's a truth really that you see when you're there, when you're in front of them, that's in their gestures, in their eyes. It's like, for example, we had an entire interview with Wael Al-Dahdouh, which we published. We interviewed all of them, by the way, but we published these interviews. And Wael is strong in this interview. He's speaking about conviction. He's speaking about standing up after losing family members and continuing to do his job, because this is what a journalist does, because he believes it's his mission to show the world the truth of what's happening. And then when the cameras are off and And I say this must be difficult to be asked this question and to have to answer it. And he just sighed. And in that sigh, you see a moment of real, I want to say, exhaustion that usually doesn't appear maybe on the cameras. But for me, it says it all. It shows the price that they're paying, what they're carrying when they're doing this job.
Exactly. And RSF has been doing, you guys have been doing a tremendous work in reporting the plight that journalists have been suffering firsthand, because it's not possible for journalists in this instance to become passive observers of everything that is going on when they are themselves being the targets of these attacks, when their families, their offices, their bureaus are being the targets of these attacks. And I wanted to ask more concretely, in what ways has Israel been targeting the journalists who are doing the work in Gaza and preventing them from doing their work? What has RSF been able to find through talking to journalists on the ground, and what through your reporting? In what ways is Israel targeting the journalists in Gaza?
Well, we thoroughly investigate every case of a journalist being harmed in any way in the course of their work. We investigate journalists all over, like in my zone, 15 countries. Unfortunately, we have a lot of these violations, journalists who are detained, arrested, killed, assassinated, taken hostage. And in Gaza, like usually, I mean, in a year, in a bad year, we'll have 3, 4, 5 cases maybe of journalists who are killed, like in a really bad year, and those will be really the emergency days that anchor the year. In Gaza, we've had 2 or 3 per day at a certain point. I cannot explain the scale of what we were witnessing, of what we continue to witness. And as Wael says in the interview, you make a mistake once, you make a mistake twice, 3 times, 10 times, you do not make a mistake 100 times. And then if you still insist that it's a mistake, then that's another kind of mistake. And I think here, what we're seeing since October 7, we're seeing a sort of attack on journalism as a whole. And the objective is clear. It is to create a media blackout in Gaza. Because effectively what we have is journalists being killed. We know that in the case of at least 22 of them, we have enough elements to speak of direct targeting linked to their jobs. The journalists were identifiable, the journalists were working, the journalists were isolated when a strike hits them, the journalists were killed by snipers, the journalists had received threats. So all of these are elements that allow us to identify immediate intentional targeting. In other cases, it's a bit more complicated because the journalists would be in their homes, they would be killed with family members. And so we also investigate those situations. We look at if the journalists had received threats, if they were working in their house, if the strikes were isolated. But the killing of journalists is taking place within a much bigger tragedy, which is beyond RSF's mandate, but it's the killing of, according to official numbers, I believe it's more than 30,000 people in Gaza. And so in that context, the specific targeting of one individual becomes a very difficult task to prove. And again, it's not for us to prove. So this is why RSF has filed complaints to the International Criminal Court on these journalists who we believe have been targeted, so that the court can do its work and investigate and bring the authors to justice. Because according to the Geneva Conventions, the targeting of civilians and journalists are civilians, that's considered a war crime. And so in that sense, whether we look at just these 22 journalists or the 100 journalists, and we add to that the fact that there have been frequent power cuts and internet cuts, there have been immense damage to infrastructure. These also have not been intentional. Since day one, we've heard Israeli officials saying that this blockade is intentional, that not a single drop of fuel, not a single drop of water will enter Gaza. These were the kinds of statements that were coming out in the beginning after the Hamas attack. When we see these statements, when we see the fact that journalists are being killed, their offices are being bombed, their houses are being bombed, they're forced to evacuate, they're forced to live in tents, they're forced to grapple and to cover the death of their family members and friends and colleagues. When we see that they were prevented from leaving Gaza, they were trapped in Rafah because it was closed. When we see that international colleagues have been unable to join them on the inside, essentially what we have is a situation where journalists are trapped inside a closed territory. They're being killed. They're working in extremely difficult conditions. They're not allowed to leave. Other journalists are not allowed to come in. And meanwhile, there's continuous propaganda, putting in question the integrity of these journalists, accusing them of being pro-Hamas, accusing them of being spokespeople for Hamas, accusing them of being combatants, of even being terrorists. In some publications, we've read that in some statements, it has been said even on an official level. And essentially, this goes to discredit the work that these journalists are doing, to prevent them from being able to do this work and to reduce them to silence. And unfortunately, what comes to fill this silence is not more silence. Most of the time, it's disinformation and propaganda. And this disinformation and propaganda will inevitably serve the actors who are on the ground, be it Hamas or be it the Israeli forces. What is sure is that it will be as far removed from the truth as possible.
And RSF has taken a step further by asking directly the International Criminal Court, ICC, to include Israeli strikes against journalists into their investigation of war crimes in Gaza. What can you tell us about this?
Effectively, these are the two complaints we filed. There's a third being prepared for war crimes committed against journalists in Gaza, because, as I said, according to the Rome Statutes of the International Criminal Court, according to the Geneva Conventions, intentional crimes against the targeting of identifiable journalists is considered a war crime. These are three since October 7, I might add, but this is not the first time we filed complaints for crimes committed against Palestinian journalists by the Israeli forces. In 2022, we supported a complaint filed by Al Jazeera for the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh in the West Bank. In 2021, we filed a complaint for the strikes against the media offices of AP and Al Jazeera in Gaza during another war. The crimes committed against journalists in the West Bank, in East Jerusalem, in Gaza, in Palestine, are systemic. They did not start with October 7. We've been seeing them. We've been monitoring them for years. In the West Bank, I mean, I can speak about the obvious case of Shireen Abu Akleh, who in a few days, it would have been 2 years since she's been killed and still no justice has been fulfilled, even though the Israeli army acknowledged that it was an Israeli soldier who killed her. All they did was apologize. They didn't even identify the author. And this is exactly the kind of impunity I was talking about. This is the impunity that allows 2 years later to not just have Shireen Abu Akleh and Ghofran Warashne was killed in the same year, but 100 more journalists killed by Israeli forces in Gaza, 3 more journalists killed in the south of Lebanon by Israeli forces. It's a pattern of impunity. And we believe that to protect these journalists, this impunity must end. There needs to be a price paid for every crime committed against a journalist, because these crimes are not just committed against the journalists. They're not just committed against Shireen Abu Akleh and Wael Dahdouh and Sami Abu Daqqa and Hamza Dahdouh. And I speak of Wael as someone who was injured, which is also a crime. They're crimes committed also against the public everywhere in the world. This is a crime against our right to know, to have verified, independent information about a war that is impacting our world. We have a right to know what's happening. The public has a right to know. And every time a journalist is killed, it is a crime being committed against this democratic right, I might add.
And almost 7 months into this war, are journalists still able to report from the ground in Gaza?
Already we have pockets of darkness in Gaza, pockets where it's almost impossible for journalists to work. Some journalists stay behind, especially in the north and in some regions of Gaza to cover. They pay an immense price. They've lost family members, homes, friends. Some of them lost their lives. Journalists who are still working in the south, they work in extremely difficult conditions. They're fearing an Israeli invasion, ground invasion of Rafah at any moment. I think almost 2 million refugee citizens are in Rafah currently, among them hundreds of journalists. And such an invasion would be an immense massacre, I believe, for these journalists. We really fear this scenario. And again, we're urging the international community to do everything in its power to avoid more crimes committed against journalists. Journalists, whether the war continues or not, whether there's a ceasefire or not, in any case, journalists should be safe and protected and allowed to work and to do their job. I mean, I can speak to you. We tend to focus on the killings and on the injuries, but even the journalists who are alive, they're not well. They live in tents. They've had to evacuate their homes. They barely sleep. They wait for hours to get water or bread. they're hungry, the food they're eating is dirty, the water they're drinking is poisonous sometimes, it's polluted. I mean, I don't want to exaggerate, but it's polluted. We've had cases of sickness amongst journalists and their families. They wait for hours to do things we don't even think of, like go to the bathroom, or they wait hours to take a short nap. They live in fear. They don't have the means to communicate because of frequent internet cuts. Once, and I hope soon this is over, many don't no longer have homes to go back to. They don't have houses. They don't have offices to work in. The scale of the destruction is immense for the press community, and that alone is something that we should all be really, we should keep in mind, I believe.
Jonathan, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
That was Jonathan Dagher, the head of the Middle East desk at Reporters Without Borders. If you want to hear first-hand accounts from journalists reporting on the ground, you can head to RSF's website, where they have been sharing interviews with reporters living through this war. If you want to comment on this episode, you can search for Friends of Europe on LinkedIn and X, or send us an email. Our address is press@friendsofeurope.org. As always, don't forget to subscribe to Friends of Europe's podcast wherever you get your podcast to never miss an episode of Policy Voices. I'm Caterina Villanova, and I'll be with you again next week. Until then, goodbye.